when we narrow our perspective and only hear from one dominant voice, that frame of reference can be sometimes a little bit too comfortable or familiar or common. And, you know, why wouldn't we want to hear from a range of voices and different experiences? I think we all benefit from that.
From Bright Umbrella, this is Control ClickCast. We inspect the web for you. Today, our friend Jess D'Amico returns to the show to talk about how Peers Conference is embracing inclusion and diversity. I'm your host, Leah Alcantara, and I'm joined by my fab co-host,
Emily Lewis.
This episode is brought to you by Mithra 62's Backup Pro, a complete backup solution for WordPress, Expression Engine 2 and 3, Craft, PrestaShop, and Concrete 5. We use this one ourselves for some of our client sites. It's insanely customizable and includes automated backup integrity, 8 built-in storage locations, console routing. Basically, Backup Pro was built to make disaster recovery as painless as possible. Just visit backup-pro.com to get started. This episode is also sponsored by Wix. Jumpstart 2017 with a stunning new website created by you. With Wix.com, you can create yours all by yourself. It's easy. Just use the drag and drop editor to customize everything. Add your text, images, videos, and more. Wix makes it easy to get your stunning website looking exactly the way you want. No tech skills needed. Plus, your website is mobile optimized, so you'll look amazing on any device. Whatever you need a website for, Wix has you covered. The possibilities are endless. So start that blog or showcase your artistic talent in a beautiful portfolio. You can even grow your business with a stunning online store or simply explore new ideas. Over 97 million people choose Wix to create their website. Make yours happen in 2017. It's easy and free. Just go to Wix.com. That's Wix.com and create your stunning website today.
We are so excited to have Jess D'Amico back on the show today. Our listeners may remember her from our EE podcast days when we had her on for our Get to Know EE CMS series. That was nearly 4 years ago, and I think just before she created Peers Conference, which is what we're talking about today. Peers is a therapeutic gathering of entrepreneurs. It has been lauded by speakers and attendees alike, known for excellent content, a diverse range of speakers, and its supportive, compassionate community. Great to have you back, Jess. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's great to be back.
So, Jess, can you tell our listeners a bit more about yourself?
Sure. I'm a web generalist from pretty much the dawn of the web. I live in Washington, D.C. with my husband and son. And that's pretty much sort of, you mentioned earlier, hobbies. I wish I could say I had more hobbies, but I have a six-year-old and my life includes a lot of Lego and a lot of Star Wars lightsaber battles.
Oh, those are good hobbies.
They are. I'm getting really good.
So I mentioned when we started, I think the last time we talked to you was before Peers was something that we knew about. Why did you create Peers? How did that evolve?
Yeah, so we are heading into our fifth Peers, which is so exciting. And the first time we did get together was sort of at the dawn of Peers, or about, you know, its first event. Peers kind of came about for two key reasons. I think one was that in attending events myself within sort of a LAMP and CMS sphere that I was working within, there always seemed to be the same core group of people that were speaking. And I think that this isn't an issue only within the events I was attending. This seems to be something that happens across the board. But what I was feeling was when you're part of a smart community and you know a smart group of people, it feels like the people sitting in the audience really are as valuable and as knowledgeable as some of the people that are called upon to present. And there's nothing against people who are speaking over and over. I think it's just that sometimes you look around and think, gee, so many of these people in this room could be up on stage. Why aren't they? And so that idea, coupled with the fact that within that community that I'm a part of, within this sort of CMS-related ecosphere, it was, in a way, a fracturing time a little bit in that community. People mm-hmm. were starting to evolve. They were building and embracing new tools. And it seemed like the time was right to see if we couldn't do something that went beyond just one tool and one skill set. And I felt strongly that as a community, we could embrace and support more than one tool. And I think we've shown that that's absolutely true. We can still be friends, even if we don't spend the entire day using the same system.
I'm not sure everyone believed that in the beginning, but you're so right. I'm so glad things have, you know, worked out the way they have in the CMS community.
Me too.
Was that always obvious, you know, from the beginning versus now?
Well, I think in the beginning, there probably was a larger CMS or software-related focus mm-hmm. potentially to peers that really has shifted, because I think that as we've evolved as a conference, we've started to look at our content more in the sense of larger frame skill set, perhaps, mm-hmm. and not so much focused on individual tools. Mm-hmm. And I think in a lot of ways, maybe that's something that makes peers appealing to a larger group of people, is that they don't have to feel like they are embracing only one choice, because when you come to peers, it's very likely that we will have something that's PHP related, something that's front end related. Mm-hmm. There's going to be a JavaScript talk. And so maybe it really doesn't matter whether you're even using a CMS or building an app. Maybe it's more along the lines of, these are the building blocks of development that bring you in the door.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of, you're describing content that's diverse, and you're describing sort of a shift that happened in the CMS ecosystem, as you put it, a couple years back, where it almost had to become more inclusive. We had to start embracing, you know, new software instead of, I mean, frankly, everyone knows what we're talking about. Everyone loved Expression Engine, and then all of a sudden people were angry at Ellis Lab and EE for a period of time that sort of coincided with the emergence of some new content management system options out there. And I feel like at the beginning of peers, sitting back and looking at how people were talking about it, everyone was like, well, how are EE and Craft going to get along? You know, how is everyone going to get along at the conference? But it's not been an issue. So from that perspective, it's been diverse and inclusive, but that's sort of a narrow approach to diversity and inclusion. How have you defined that for your conference and embraced it?
Well, I think hopefully in some ways it's just by sort of setting a model for good behavior, although I'm not sure I am that model. But I think the other thing is that, again, you really can't keep a narrow scope. I think the bigger issue is not focusing on the tools, but focusing on the people. And mm-hmm. that when we talk about diversity and inclusion, what my goal always is to say to the larger world out there, regardless of what tool they use, or even really if they're using a tool at all, it's more along the lines of, you are welcome here. You mm-hmm. are going, if you're spending the day building something, if you're spending the day coding something, if you're spending the day managing a project or managing a team, and if you're spending the day running a software business or running an agency, you are welcome here. You're going to find something for you at this conference, and you're going to find someone or a group of someones who share your experience.
So when you were defining all of this, like, were you very specific in regards to, because right now it seems the general idea of diversity, like everyone's included, but generally speaking, when people talk about diversity and inclusion, we're talking about marginalized communities. And when I'm saying that, I mean people of different genders or gender identities, as well as different sexualities, as well as people of color. Was that something that you were intentional about when you were thinking about diversity, or did that just kind of naturally evolve when you wanted to create an open environment and everyone is welcome kind of theme?
That's a great question. I think that really it is an evolution. I think in the beginning there wasn't a grand master plan,
right? Mm-hmm.
And there still isn't, along the lines of, oh, we must be X, Y, or Z. And I think that if anything, running a conference and working with more people has taught me, you certainly cannot be all things to all people.
Right.
I'm guilty sometimes of trying to try. I will say, though, that from my own experience attending conferences over the years and not always feeling that, quote unquote, I belong there, or, you know, feeling other people's reactions towards me of, who are you? While it wasn't something that I originally thought, I want to reach out to XYZ community or set specific goals in place, I want all people to feel like they are valuable and have worth at Peers and that they are welcome there. I don't want anyone to ever walk in the room and sort of feel that, you know, like needle on the record of, gee, who are you? Right. And I think that by being very open, at least I hope, by being very open, by being transparent about that goal, and by setting, again, a friendly and I hope inclusive tone, we are saying year after year, this is an event for you, no matter who you are. I think one of the things that I've tried to do, though, along the way is reach out to different speakers and or encourage different speakers who might have felt previously that they didn't see themselves on stage. And I think when we talk about marginalized communities in any scheme of society, whether it be the workplace or whether it be television or anything else, I think it comes down to the ability to see oneself. And that's what most people feel like they want to see themselves in a setting. And so if we can do that because we are including a variety of speakers from all walks of life and from all gender identities, and hopefully that are representing various ethnic groups, also that are representing various areas of both experience and age. I'm hoping that in doing that, we can walk the walk and show people, hey, you belong here. You will see yourself here. That, I think, is the long-term goal.
You know, I want to talk a little bit about the speakers, but before that, it's clear to me, you know, the benefit of having this type of inclusive environment is so that, you know, one, people are comfortable and get something from being there, whether it's from, you know, camaraderie or professional advice, or they learn something new. But other benefits, are there bigger benefits for the conference itself being something that is known to be diverse and inclusive?
Well, I hope so. I don't know if there are sort of immediate takeaways in terms of that. But again, I'm going to just bring it back to the goals of saying, if we felt as an event we could bring more people to the table and have more people in the room, why wouldn't we want to do that? And if we felt that we could reach out to various groups of people and say, gee, you coded in Python last year, and hey, you designed something last year, and hey, you two don't look anything alike, and maybe there's 20 years of difference between you, but we still think that you could sit down and learn from each other, why wouldn't we want to do that? I think when we narrow our perspective and only hear from one dominant voice, that frame of reference can be sometimes a little bit too comfortable or familiar or common. And, you know, why wouldn't we want to hear from a range of voices and different experiences? I think we all benefit from that.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I would say that my perspective is that you don't know what you don't know, right?
Exactly.
And the only way you can go past that is to get out of your comfort zone and speak to people of different experiences, you know, at the end of the day. It's comfortable, of course, hanging out with people of like minds or like backgrounds, et cetera, and so forth. But anytime you want to grow as a professional or as a person, the only way to do that is to find different perspectives or different ways to view the same thing. Now, clearly, all three of us agree on the benefits. No one really here is disagreeing about that. But, you know, playing devil's advocate, are there any particular drawbacks as an organizer for you, you know, by having this type of mindset and way of running a conference?
I wouldn't say drawbacks in the way that perhaps other people might look at it. What I will say is, and again, this is something that I'm really proud of, is that I think we've become known as a conference where you can find your footing as a speaker. And I have said through the years that we champion first timers, and I mean it. If you've never spoken at a conference before and you feel strongly that you have something to share, chances are you should submit to peers, and maybe you have. I think on many years have an almost equal balance of people who are, you know, either within the speaker circuit or very comfortable speaking, and people who are speaking for their first time. And I would say that while that's not a drawback in terms of an event, sometimes it can be harder to build your audience on the ideas of first timers. I will say, though, on the opposite side of that, from a very positive, I think it speaks to the wonderful, amazing audience of peers and the fact that it is a fantastic community, and it's full of respectful people who come back year after year, and they as an audience have always welcomed and embraced and been so supportive of both our first timers and our mainstream speakers. And it really shows there's always a lot of respect and love in the room. Mm.
I just also want to point out that even the mainstream speakers had to speak for the first time at one point in their lives. I still remember 10 plus years ago when I first started speaking, and a lot of the mainstream names that we know now, they were also speaking for the first time at that time. And conferences weren't as vast and prolific as it is these days. And so at some point, somebody needs to start somewhere.
Absolutely.
And I'm one of those who I find it refreshing. I've been to enough tech events, and looking at even, I haven't been to a tech event in probably, what, a year and a half. But if I look at the lineup of any given tech event this year, it's probably pretty close to what I saw 2 years ago at my last tech event. I find it extremely refreshing as someone who's throwing down, you know, $500, maybe more, to attend an event to, I've already seen so-and-so speak 3 times, actually, because they're so popular, but I know what they have to say. I've heard it, and I want to hear other voices and other ideas about how other people work.
Yeah, I think absolutely. I also think it's just, again, I totally understand where that comes from. I think it can happen because sometimes it's easier, and sometimes you get people who submit over and over, and sometimes maybe it's a little bit of, you know, taking the easy way out on the part of organizers, or failing to kind of try to make your own awareness more broad. But I've just found it's so nice when we can have new people. And I think, yeah, it takes a little bit more work sometimes to try to stay aware and encourage people and give them the nudge. Mm-hmm. We have had times where we've reached out to people and said, you know, we think you would make a good speaker. We hope you will consider applying. If you are a first-time speaker and you come to us and say, gee, I'm a little nervous, or I'm trying something out for the first time, I mean what I say when I say that I want to foster the growth and development of people and try to help support them in any way I can. So if you are a first-timer, chances are you and I are going to spend some time on the phone. I may help you with an outline. I may help you build an understanding of our audience in any way I can. And I'm certainly going to want to maybe even hear your talk, you know, by myself, and encourage you to practice it as much as possible. So I'm hoping we can do everything we can do on our end to encourage people to, you know, give it a shot.
Jess, that's just so nice. If I can just put a personal anecdote out there, when I was beginning my public speaking, brief public speaking career, I was very interested in speaking at a relatively large, well-known event. And I spoke to one of the organizers, and I expressed I'm one of those wearing my heart on my sleeve people. And so I expressed, you know, I'm nervous, you know, do you have any tips? And the very statement of me expressing my nervousness essentially took me off of his list. He didn't want anyone with nerves. He didn't want anyone who was questioning themselves. He only wanted a certain type of, you know, proficient or something like that. And, you know, it really turned me off, not only to that event, but just that idea. Like, I was really excited to talk about something and share something that I knew with a larger audience. And he was fine and excited about it until I expressed my personal feelings about being nervous. And I think you should be able to do that, because you want your conference organizer to be supportive of you.
Yeah, I think that's crap.
Yeah.
And I think also, you know, on two fronts, one, it's asking for perfection that nobody has. But also, I hope, you know, no one is more nervous to get on stage at peers than I am. And I get on stage, you know, constantly throughout the event. And the audience knows, like when I first start out, I'm sort of gripping the podium like, hi, guys, it's another new year. Yay. And somewhere through the event, I kind of find my rhythm. But I think, you know, it is your job. Like, I want to be able to say that Peers rises and falls on its content. And in order to do that, that means it's all about the speakers. People don't come to this event to see me. They come to see an amazing group of professionals and hopefully learn something of value that they can take home and use in their business throughout the year. And I take that really seriously. I know they have limited time and a limited budget, and they have to make a choice every year about which event they can attend, if any. And that attendance is an honor. I want to earn it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's so strange that anyone would be put off by anybody who is nervous, because I think nervousness is a natural reaction to caring about something, right?
And, absolutely.
And so I think anybody who is slightly nervous cares about what they're doing. And I think it's just a natural physiological reaction. It's not unnatural at all. And, you know, even me, I'm not the shy type of person, but I always get nerves that nobody notices because I care about what I'm about to say. So anybody who's listening who is nervous about speaking, it's completely natural. And find a peer who, you know, is there to support you and, you know, cheer you on along the way. And just another like side note, for example, like Emma Stone, who's this famous actress who I love, she constantly talks about how she has anxiety attacks because that's just who she is. She gets nervous whenever she has to act and do certain things. And yet you don't see that on screen because she's a professional. Right? The thing is, nerves are natural. It's fine. You'll get through it.
I think sometimes people are confusing nervousness with a lack of preparation.
Yes. Or incompetence. Mm-hmm.
So it's important to understand that you should prepare and prepare and prepare and over prepare. And in that context, you may or may not still be nervous, but even if you're nervous, people will understand that it's the act of standing on the stage in front of people, not that you don't know what you're talking about mm-hmm. and that you didn't do your homework. And so I think that's an important distinction to make.
Mm-hmm. So Jess, you mentioned a little bit about as you're looking for speakers, you actively seek people who you think might, you know, be a good first timer, nudge people with the idea. What else do you do in terms of finding speakers and good topics, particularly with the idea of a diverse group of people and diverse content?
Sure. So I think the primary thing that I try to do throughout the year and all the time is just to pay attention. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to pay attention in a lot of different ways. We don't solicit any content specifically in terms of asking our speakers to cover a specific topic. However, I try to pay attention on Twitter. I try to pay attention to other conferences. I try to pay attention to who's talking about what or who's running maybe different meetup organizations that are like-minded and are covering the same kinds of topics. So that when it is time for our CFP to go online, I can do everything I can to reach out to as many organizations and people as possible and say, hey, you may or may not have heard of us. You might be wondering what we're about. Please check out our CFP. When we started Peers years ago, I don't think the first year we had any female applicants. Mm-hmm. There have always been women who have spoken at Peers from the very first year, but I believe that first year I reached out to women in the community and basically said, yeah, you have to be here. Mm-hmm. I need you. And I still do that to an extent from time to time. There's always people we invite to speak at Peers. They range from people I'm paying attention to and people who form sort of a dream list for me, what have you. But what is exciting to me is that through a few of the steps we have taken, that applicant pool has gotten so much bigger. And by diversifying the applicant pool, we then have a more inclusive event because we're diversifying the group of people that appear on our stage. And so we've been able to do that by reaching out to lots of organizations, primarily on Twitter or through websites where you can sign up to let them know about our event. Organizations like Callback Women, organizations that basically promote CFPs in general and say, hey, they tweet out, you know, so-and-so CFP is open, go take a look. So by letting more people know, by working with people in the community directly and reaching out to whether it's different podcasts, there are so many organizations. So one thing that's exciting is that, you know, there are the large organizations involved in trying to get women, minorities, everyone involved in tech. And so whether it's Girl Develop It, whether it's Women Who Code, whether it's Black Girls Code, there's so many organizations that we're trying to be aware of and make sure they're aware of us. We can offer discounted tickets and be part of newsletters that let people know, hey, you might not know about this event, but you should attend, you should apply to speak. So I kind of feel like it's a broad collaborative effort. And then finally, we really just call on a lot of allies in the industry and try to work with as many women and as many people in the industry as possible to say, hey, please pass this on. I think myself and lots of conference organizers have sometimes been guilty of the initial fallacy, you know, if you build it, they will come. That is not true. You have to really hammer people over the head and remind them, hey, we're here. We want to do the right thing. We want to have the goal of just an amazing broad spectrum speaker roster. Please help us reach that goal.
Right. And I also like the point that sometimes you do have to hit people over the head over it because either they're not self-aware or there's just too much signal to noise, depending on whatever's happening in their life or business or their career. It just reminded me of a story when I was speaking at a conference and I was just chatting with just another female attendee there. And she talked about how like, oh, one day I'd like to speak. And then I just asked her like, well, why don't you apply now? It was just always an idea in her mind that it was sometime in the future, always sometime in the future. And she used her age as a way to say like, well, I'm still very young or whatever. And to be frank, like my first speaking experience was when I was 22. So when I told her that, she immediately was like, oh, you mean I can start doing that now? Right? So sometimes you need to kind of like really be blatant that yes, you can. You have something to say. You have something to contribute. If you already have certain ideas, you can already start trying. But sometimes people don't understand that they have those opportunities until someone explicitly tells them. And, you know, as another aside, almost all speaking opportunities that I've ever had has been an invite.
Yeah, I mean, same with me. I've never submitted a talk. I've always been invited. And it was the act of being invited that I said, huh.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, having been an audience member for years, sitting back, watching speakers and thinking in my head, I could do that.
Right.
Not that I could be on stage, but that I could talk about that, that I knew something to share. But it was only until someone reached out and specifically asked.
Yeah, well, I think that's important. And I think that in the beginning of Peers, there was definitely more of an invitation process. However, one of the things that I think we've tried to do is move away from that. As our conference has gotten a little bit more popular, we have more and more submissions every year. And then when you spoke about support, I think the other thing, so this goes back to sort of hitting people over the head, although I really don't want to do that to get them to Peers. But in terms of hitting people over the head with the understanding that their ideas are valid and yes. will be taken seriously, I think that some people have had a negative experience applying to speak and let that experience color their future in thinking that if it went poorly once, it may not go well again. And so to overcome that, we actually instituted a whole system that I'm very proud of that is a blind review process of our applicants. And that has kind of grown and been redefined over the years as we've kind of, not redefined as much as fine-tuned it, but essentially similar to a web project that we're all familiar with, where we think there are personas using and being involved in the process, we kind of have some personas for attendees at peers, and then we've been able to build a content review panel based on those personas to sort of say, who's coming to peers? What are they looking for? Let's have representative people that are then reviewing our content, but let's take it one step further and review it blindly. So this year, there are four people on the content review panel. There are two women, two men, their front end and back end and on staff and not, and then the deciding vote is my own, so that when a talk comes into our review panel, all we see is the title and the abstract of the talk, and then we throw in a tidbit about why that person wants to speak at peers. And in doing that, we are really comparing apples to apples because each application really needs to stand on its own. And I feel like that has really put us in a different place. I realize we're not the only conference to do this, but it really came back to us last year when we had a speaker sort of stand up and say that they had been told the only reason they were speaking at another event was because they were a woman. Mm. And she mentioned that it really kind of took the air out of her sails, and that here she was arriving to do her talk and put her best foot forward, and then, you know, have this organizer sort of turn around and say, well, you're here because we need to fill a spot.
Right.
And what I feel like is we're not really talking about filling spots. We're talking about producing the best content we can year after year. And by getting known for that, I think having more applicants and getting better content as a result. And no one was more excited about this than me when last year, through again our blind content review panel, we ended up with an entire dev track of women.
Nice.
And awesome. I was like, woohoo, you know, tell me you can't do this. You can do this. And so that was very exciting for anyone who's listening. If you were at peers, you will know that we didn't have an all-female dev track because one of our speakers had to back out and there was a conflict with her company and something. So she couldn't actually come to peers. So that ended up changing. But it was an exciting moment where it felt like something that I had been working towards for a long time was being realized by sort of trying to tweak and refine the system year after year.
I feel like what I'm hearing from you is a really different approach from what I think we more traditionally hear about tech conferences, trying to have a diverse speaker representation, where you're creating an environment where everyone's welcome to start with. And like, you're walking the walk. You're not just saying you're doing it, you're doing it. And by creating this type of environment, it's naturally attracting a diverse group of people, of speakers, of attendees, that it's this mentality versus some formula. Do you think that's fair?
I hope so. I think that again, would obviously be the goal. You know, it's not enough, I feel, to just want to do something or say you're going to do something. You have to actually do it. And obviously, you know, I'm not perfect. We're not doing everything right. And these goals aren't fully realized. We still have a long way to go. Our audience attendees are mainly male, and I would love, love, love to see more women in the audience at peers. I think they would find that they are welcome at this event and that they, you know, have something to share and something to learn. But certainly, I think what really helps drive peers is people's experience and the fact that they come home and share it and tweet it and talk about it with their colleagues, and they leave feeling different maybe than a different event. We are not a large corporate event, and you can feel it. You're going to feel it by being welcomed by the people at the event. You're going to feel it because we ask a lot of our speakers and that we want them to stick around and be part of the community for 2 to 3 days and meet people and find as much value in the audience as the audience gives back to those on the stage. So in trying to do things maybe a little bit differently, hopefully then maybe we get a different result.
So I feel like this next question has already been semi-answered since you explained your thorough blind application process, but I want you to consider the question yourself. Basically, our listener, Pat Poehler, was talking about how some people in our industry actually complain that actively organizing for speaker diversity or wider representation runs counter to good conferences because speakers, quote, should be judged by merit, technical experience, etc. As someone who runs a great conference, do you think about this attitude and does it match up with your actual experience?
Well, sure. I can't do my job well and not be aware of attitudes that exist, you know, both in the world and sort of in an attendee context. I would say within the peers realm, I think there's less of that. I think someone recently wrote some kind of crappy article about how, you know, if someone else got a spot, then instead of their idea of who should be getting a spot, then it's a terrible thing. You know, it's a hard situation only to me in the context that when we insist that everything happen for merit, we are ideally sort of looking at a kind of perfect world scenario that we don't always live in. And I think that when you realize that different people get to the table at different speeds, if at all, for me, I feel like, again, by trying to have different voices represented, be they age, color, gender, identity, what have you, is that something we're actively going out and seeking? Like we're trying to check little boxes? No, but what we are trying to say is chances are someone like you has been on our stage and or in our room, and we want you here too. I'm not sure that I fully answered the question in the context of do you take something away from someone and give it to someone else? To me, that sounds like a terrible attitude, kind of in the context of scarcity. Like there's only so much right. to go around. But
it also presumes what makes a good conference. I mean, my God, like I was talking earlier, I'm so sick of seeing the same people. Like, it doesn't matter. They've been doing it for 20 years. Like, I don't care anymore. And a good conference for me would be like a really refreshing presentation from someone who's got a totally different take on it. I think that the person who wrote that post, I know who it is, and I think he's an asshole, and basically think that it's all ego. And it's a presumption of what makes a good conference for everyone else based on his definition. It's ridiculous. That kind of mentality is why we have these kind of problems in our industry.
Yeah, and I think Jess's point about the scarcity myth yeah. is a big one because
it's a myth, yeah.
Yeah, well, because just as I mentioned, I feel like conferences have exploded right now.
Conferences have exploded. I think a lot of people have felt like there's an opportunity to make a lot of money. Buyer beware, that is not true.
Yeah. FYI, no.
You got to do it really well and you've got to scale quickly. Go with God. Good luck.
Jess, you mentioned that, you know, thus far your audience is mostly male. What are you doing to try and change that? You mentioned that you sometimes offer like discounted tickets to different groups.
We certainly do that. So I think probably we aren't doing as much publicly as we should be, as opposed to private channel. I do a lot in the context of private channels, whether it's just reaching out to women in the community and asking them if there's a way I can help get them to peers, or I'm part of a lot of different Slack groups and organizations where I'm talking about peers from the context of, hey, you might not know about this event, check it out. If you're a special group, whether you're a meetup group, there's, you know, Women Who Code DC has a huge Slack group. And so for organizations like that, I'll usually be in the Slack room and talking about the fact that peers exists, and we're going to give a promo code to this organization and hope that that helps. So it's building awareness through different channels. And then also, you know, like anything else in life, it's sort of like, if you liked this, tell your friend, tell your friend, tell your friend. So any way that we can sort of say to people, again, I think it comes down to visibility. And this is something that while we talk about for the stage and for any group that feels marginalized or feels like they are a minority, part of that key is feeling visible, feeling like they see themselves there. And so again, I want women to come to peers and realize that there are women in the room, there are women in the audience, and they're going to feel comfortable there.
Speaking of comfort level, one of our listeners, Pat Poehler, he had a question about what can organizers and attendees do to help make sure conferences are safe for everyone, especially at after-hour events.
Right. So it's a big topic, and rightly so. I think that everyone's approach is different, so I can only speak for my own and as it sort of reflects my own expectations as an attendee. One of the things that we do, obviously, is have a code of conduct. I say obviously because I feel like we've promoted that and you can see it on our site. But for those who don't know, or for those who feel like that's not an obvious, I think at this moment in time where we are, events should have a code of conduct. There are people, again, in the larger universe who feel that that's a waste of time or it isn't needed. Everyone's entitled to their opinion. But again, to me, that harks back to the idea of perfect world scenario. So in a perfect world, we may not need a code of conduct. I don't believe as a professional that if other events are embracing a code of conduct, I can afford not to. And on a personal level, it seems like a good thing to do. I do think that there is, you know, a level of expectation that has to be met on both sides. I have learned in life as an organizer, I'm probably still learning this in life, there's very, very little I can control. And so I have to go into it with that expectation when I throw an event. And instead of thinking about guaranteeing a certain experience or guaranteeing one's safety or comfort level in the context of what I can control, I have to instead approach it as a, what can I prepare for? And so instead, that is how I approach it, and I take it extraordinarily seriously. I take it seriously because we have insurance for every venue that we go to. But more than that, I take it seriously because I would feel terrible if I thought somebody was having a terrible time at peers. I've been through my own shit at conferences where people have been crappy to me and way unprofessional. And I don't want that to happen to anybody else at my event, no matter what they look like. So beyond having a code of conduct, again, when it comes back to walking the walk, I will say at the onset, we have never had an incident that I am aware of during peers at an event or after that I am aware of. And I tell every year our speakers and our sponsors and our supporters that we are the best community in tech. And I absolutely believe that. Having said that, knowing that we live in the real world and having a code of conduct, when I interview a venue, when I contract with a venue, I sit down with their security team. I sit down with the planners and I'm going to look those people in the eye and shake their hand, and we're going to have a conversation about what it means to provide security at the event. They're going to understand that we have a code of conduct. They're also going to understand that, like, I'm a 5'4" person, and unless you really piss me off and I'm going to throw you over my shoulder, chances are I am not equipped to evict someone from my own event. And that's the point of having security. That's the point of you know, of hiring and contracting with a professional venue. And then that conversation carries over not just from our conference space, but it also happens at the hotel that we contract with to provide rooms when we do a room block and get people a discount on a specific hotel. It's the reason why if we serve liquor at an event that's tied to the conference, we do that in a public space that is licensed to serve liquor. We don't serve it ourselves. And we're using professional bartenders at a professional restaurant or a professional bar to create, again, a safe space in the context of serving liquor and making a judgment call isn't my job. There are people who do that for a living. We're going to hire those people. And so approaching it from a context of, again, I can't guarantee there's a lot of liability potentially, but what I can try to do is imagine the things that could go wrong. You know, have I checked out the venue? Is there lighting? Are there bathrooms? Are they nice? If we're asking people to take public transportation, or if we're recommending cabs, or if we recommend that they walk because we're providing different venues, is it safe? And it's, you know, I'm a city person. I live in the middle of Washington, D.C., and so I'm very used to walking and being aware. But I also realize that that isn't the case of some of my attendees. So I want to make sure that if I am asking people to walk around a place they've never been before, they're going to be okay.
I think it's the point about having a code of conduct. You know, conduct, people may suggest it's not necessary. It makes me think back to our episode with Dan Maalea. He basically said that unless you know what the rules are, you don't know whether you're following them or not.
Right.
And, you know, it applies in a team environment. It applies in an agency. It applies everywhere. Someone needs to establish what's expected of you so that you can live up to that expectation. It doesn't presume negative or positive. It just says, this is what we expect, you know? And once that's known, then you can enforce it if necessary. But it has to be known to start with, not just so you can enforce it, but also so people know what's expected of them.
Right. And then I think also, I think there is the responsibility of expectation also on the part of the attendee, in the sense that for a conference like ours and for smaller events, your expectations can't be wildly out of line with the event. I'm going to do my best to provide a safe and enjoyable experience, you know, during the conference hours and at the places we go and everything else. If you, however, are having a great time and suddenly something happens to you at a public place at 4 a.m, I'm going to be upset and I'm going to want to help you, but I don't know that I can reasonably be expected to have prevented that in any grand scheme of things.
So Emily kind of mentioned the enforcing the particular rules. How would you enforce the rules? Because I do understand that, you know, a lot of people can have a code of conduct, copy paste something from several different things. But unless people feel like the code of conduct will be enforced if/when an incident occurs, then it's not a power, like, you know, the code of conduct is just useless otherwise, right? So how would you enforce the rules, and how do you impress upon attendees that the rules are going to be enforced?
That's a good question. I think it's hard to imagine without really saying that it would have to be a case-by-case basis. However, in the sense of if something were to happen at, you know, at our main venue and during our event, like I said before, that's one of the reasons that I try to approach and work with security, is so that there's an understanding from advance. If I say something has happened and this person has created a disturbance or, you know, done something to someone else and they need to be removed maybe today or maybe forever, we have to find out more, you know, they're prepared to do that because we've already imagined that scenario and gone beyond imagining it to actually talking and planning for it. So in that sense, I feel not prepared, but I do feel like it is not beyond the scope of my imagination that we might need to deal with something. I think a harder thing to imagine how you'll sort of react in the moment is when things get out of line online. And again, I think some of it is how you set your tone and how you deal with your audience and I always want to be sort of a sphere of positivity online as it relates to the event, so that even if something is going wrong, I'm not going to take it online. I would prefer to try to deal with it in person. So again, sort of thinking about it in a case by case, you know, if somebody were tweeting or there were a problem, you know, we would have to try to deal with an individual, I think.
So Jess, in 5 years of running Peers, what mistakes have you learned from?
Oh gosh. Well, I've made a ton of mistakes. I don't know if I've learned from any of them. You know, probably the biggest one is just assuming that people pay more attention than they do, whether it's on Twitter or online, or the idea that, you know, if you build it, people come. So I think that understanding that from a marketing perspective, you have to be doing everything you can. And from a content or intention perspective, you're always trying to put your best foot forward. Mm-hmm. And then I think there's a bit of sort of like Boy Scout motto, be prepared aspect to event running that has helped me in the sense of approaching it logistically. And part of that is just trying to plan for every possible disaster that you can imagine. Right. Not because you will be able to prepare for all of them, but if you try to imagine as many bad things as possible that could go wrong, you won't imagine like the exact scenario, but maybe you'll have prepared for the ones you can imagine, so you're better prepared to handle the other things. Mm-hmm. I got some great advice from Alan Branch when I was starting out. So all shout right. out to Alan, who again ran me through that kind of scenario of like everything that can possibly go wrong. And everything, you know, in a Murphy's Law context that could happen will happen. So your catering will get delivered to the wrong place and a speaker will back out and this will happen, or there'll be a problem with your building or your Wi-Fi or your temperature or what have you, or somebody that you wouldn't expect will get on stage and they'll have a strange case of stage fright. And so sometimes things that people grumble about are actually ways that organizers are trying to protect themselves, because maybe if they call in the slides, it isn't so much to say, hey, I want to review your content. It's, hey, I want to have a familiarity with your talk so that if you need any prompting, maybe I can help you. Mm. Because there have been all kinds of crazy scenarios, even so much as like we thought my laptop died in the middle of some sort of presentation, I think when we were in DC, and it wasn't actually something that was affecting the conference, but I personally was thinking, oh, please don't be dead, laptop. I need you. So, you know, it's all kinds of things can happen. I think you can't be too prepared. So in terms of learning from your mistakes, it's just try to pay attention to every single little detail and everything everybody else does so that maybe you can learn as much as possible.
Mm. So in regards to, you know, planning all of this, what resources did you rely on to help you create a more diverse, inclusive event? Are there any other events you modeled Peers after?
I think, again, it more comes back to the idea of building a people-focused event and a feeling rather than seeking out the ideas of either diversity or sort of, again, filling boxes. I think it comes back to having been to events that are either boring or not inspiring. I try to seek out events that I feel are what I kind of call full person event, where maybe they're not about a specific language or a specific software, but they're again, sort of embracing a more positive side to humanity and what we do as people in addition to just what we do at work. Over the years, I've attended some great events like Brooklyn Beta and or XOXO, both of which I think have in some ways, they have elements of what I'm trying to achieve or vice versa. I don't know that I could say I'm modeling Peers on anything specific, because I feel like we are such a hybrid in so many ways, which is why sometimes it's very hard to actually explain well what Peers is, which is why I loved that whole entrepreneurs idea. You know, we also have a business track. Very few conferences take business seriously. Mm. And I feel like in a community of business owners and people who care about what they do, Peers is a thinking person's conference. It's a craftsperson conference in the sense of I don't get a sense of sort of like lackadaisical cynicism from our audience. People want to be there, and they want to be there year after year to learn something new and to see each other and be present in that community. So that's the feeling that I want. And it has to do as much with that when people walk into the room, they're all so happy to see each other.
So before we finish up, what advice would you give to a budding conference organizer with the perspective of trying to have a people-focused, inclusive event?
I think first and foremost, I would say run. Just do not, you know, do not try this. No, I'm kidding. My first event, honestly, is pay attention. Like, try to pay attention to everything. Keep your eyes and ears open. There are so many great sources, podcasts, groups, meetups, chats going on. And so if you really feel like you can't find people, I'm making air quotes, I don't believe you. And not to shame anyone or make anyone feel guilty, but just along the lines of saying there are so many sources and so many places that we can look for input, you know, and if you tell people that you take it seriously, they will come and give you their great ideas. And when you talked before about seeking content, our applications and the content that we get from our speakers are so much better than anything I could ever imagine. Every year, I'm always blown away and I'm excited and humbled by the fact that such smart people want to be part of this. So paying attention to absolutely everything and everyone that you can, because at an event, the devil is in the details. And those details are things from, you know, does the lock on the bathroom door work? To am I freezing and miserable so that I can't focus on the content? To is a tall person going to be able to fit in this chair and are they going to block the short person behind them? To does the person who's gluten-free have something to eat at lunch? And so on and so forth. There's a lot of small details and they all really relate to people. So I think if you can frame it and keep it in mind in the sense of people, that will really help.
And what about advice for a conference speaker or someone who wants to get into speaking?
I think hopefully it's both get into it for the right reasons in the sense of sharing, perhaps. I think that that's sometimes a challenge too. You know, like every industry, once people become part of quote unquote a speaker circuit, chances are they may speak more than they do other things. And so it really depends on your audience. Some audiences want an extremely polished, prepared speaker that's presenting at a very high level in terms of, I'm going to say, again, like that polished sense. I think at peers, there is a tremendous value of knowledge and experience over perhaps the number of times that you've spoken and whether or not you're wearing a blazer. So I think that sometimes, you know, it's a catch-22 as an organizer. Big names help sell tickets. At the same time, anytime I think I'm sort of scoring a coup sometimes because it's like, wow, this is going to be so great. Sometimes the audience comes back to me with, that really wasn't a good fit for us. Or this speaker seems to really just be interested and motivated by their speaking and not so much by what they do. And so that's a challenge too. There are what I like to call drive-by speakers who cluster events together and they do five events in 5 days and they go from one to the next and they give a really nice talk and shake a few hands and move on. And that's totally their prerogative. Generally, that is not what we ask of our speakers, and our audience responds differently to those kinds of situations.
And then any advice for attendees?
I think for attendees, part of it is also having a goal maybe of what you want to get out of your conference. I mean, again, one of the reasons that I started Peers was as a small business owner, you know, money and time are what we live and die by.
Right.
And so I felt that I couldn't afford to attend a conference that I didn't learn something and that didn't bring some value to me and to my business. And again, you know, my advice to everybody is take it seriously. I take it really seriously. I think when you attend an event, you're spending money and you're spending time. And as a small business owner, you can lose time in the process, and then that lost time costs you. So, you know, what do you want to get out of? If you want to get work, if you want to get connections, you actually have to show up and shake a few hands and say hi to people.
Right.
And people don't believe me that that works, but I promise that work. Every year, huge connections are made at peers, and people go home and build things together. They build software together. They work together. Somebody gets hired, and people don't believe me that that happens. And I'm here telling you that absolutely happens. So if you want somebody to hire you as a freelancer down the line and everyone's hanging out at the end of the day, go say hi to that person. Let them know you exist. Again, maybe you're both following each other on Twitter, but people aren't really paying attention. Mm-hmm. Make the connection.
Yeah, I love absolutely. That. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, side note, Emily and I met at a conference. So
we sure did. 2009 South by Southwest.
Woo-woo.
Wow.
All right. So before we finish up, we've got our rapid fire 10 questions so our listeners can get to know you a bit better. Are you ready, Jess?
Yikes.
Okay. First question. Introvert or extrovert?
Oh, extrovert. So extroverted.
All right. The power is going to be out for the next week. What food from the fridge do you eat first?
Well, the ice cream.
Nice.
That's sort of a given no matter what.
What's your favorite website for fun?
Oh, gosh. I don't know. I don't think I have enough fun on the internet, which is sad. I will say this. I'm following a cake decorator on Instagram, and I am entranced by these cake decorating videos that are then sped up, and you can watch this elaborate cake be formed in about 30 seconds. I just sit there, and yeah, that's what I'm doing.
What's the last thing you read?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. Something probably from the Times Magazine this weekend, but nothing ever comes to mind when you guys ask me this question. I will say I read entirely too much news, especially lately online, and not enough sort of reading for pleasure. So that probably says a lot about me, unfortunately.
What's the best piece of professional advice you've ever received?
Ask for what you want.
Good one. What's the worst piece of professional advice you've received?
Maybe someone recently who didn't hire me because they thought I trash talked the software they wanted to use, but I just couldn't help myself. You got to stay true to your convictions.
What's your favorite color?
Purple.
If you could take us to one restaurant in DC, where would we go?
Oh my God.
I know it's a hard one.
Lately, my take someone restaurant of choice is, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing this right. It's called China Chilcano by Jose Andres, and it's sort of a mixture of Peruvian, Japanese, Asian fusion food with fantastic drinks and amazing pisco. Oh, it's really good.
What's your favorite board game?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe Monopoly.
All right, last question. Hulu or Netflix?
Oh, Netflix. I'm lame.
So that's all the time we have for today. Thanks for coming back on the show, Jess, and best of luck with peers this April.
Thanks so much for having me. Always a pleasure.
In case our listeners want to follow up with you, where can they find you online?
They should probably find me on Twitter. My personal Twitter is at JustJessDC. PiersConf is on Twitter at PiersConf. You can also reach out to us through PiersConf.com and send us an email there and tell us all of your secrets.
Awesome. Thanks, Jess.
Take care.
Control Click is produced by Bright Umbrella, a web services agency obsessed with happy clients. Today's podcast would not be possible without the support of this episode's sponsors. Thank you, Backup Pro and Wix.
We'd also like to thank our partners, Arcus Tech and Devotee.
And thanks to our listeners for tuning in. If you want to know more about Control Click, make sure you follow us on Twitter at Control Clickcast or visit our website, controlclickcast.com. And if you like this episode, please give us a review on Stitcher or iTunes or both. And if you really like this episode, consider donating to the show. Links are in our show notes and on our site.
Don't forget to tune in to our next episode when Leah and I are going to talk about retrofitting desktop sites for mobile. Be sure to check out controlclickcast.com/schedule for more upcoming topics.
This is Leah Alcantara
and Emily Lewis
signing off for Control Clickcast. See you next time.
Cheers.